the happiness in the world.
I'm glad to have this chance to talk to you. I'm not an old-fashioned father. I know the day of asking a parent's consent to his child's marriage is gone. I suppose I should be happy even to be told of my daughter's marriage. Well, I am happy, and I don't have to tell her that my one thought in life is happiness, welfare, and contentment. It's going to seem funny to hear my old friend and client call me Papa. But I expect to get used to that. It's one of the penalties of my extreme age.
Oh, you're not bad.
But, my son, I want to assure you that my one thought, now and always, is Barbara's happiness. You may remember that only this afternoon I told you to what lengths I'd go to ensure that happiness. I'm glad to tell you that again. Please to remember, all the hours of your life, there are no lengths to which I will not go to ensure my child's happiness. You remember that, my boy, won't you? All the rest of your life. And now, everybody get up. And we'll drink a royal toast and break your glasses to my old friend Gordon Rich on his the eve of his wedding. All the happiness in the world and a long, long life.
Yeah. Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, and welcome everybody to another episode of Forgotten Horrors, the podcast. I think there's a colon before the, maybe. Michael, before we get into it, what's your latest project that's out and about on the market?
Ooh, boy, I tell you what, just finishing up the second volume of the Ghost Gallery restoration.
Oh, good, good.
I use the term restorations very, very lightly. Series, of course, as you well know, deals more in restoring the art and then vandalizing the original dialogue.
In a kind of a stream of consciousness Dadaistic way.
Yes, exactly. A lot of non sequiturs, a lot of corny old vaudeville gags, too many knock-knock jokes to keep track of.
A lot of cops eating donuts.
Cops eating donuts.
Certainly one of my favorite recurring motifs in your work in that,
well,
that area.
Well, you know, you get repetitive for good or ill. And I find that the temptation to get repetitive kind of overrides any concerns about whether it might be for good or ill.
You just got to kind of press forward, don't you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You just, you know, you bull on through and hope either somebody notices or hope nobody notices. I have no idea which way that works.
Or if someone notices that they enjoy it.
Yes,
that's very
exactly
important.
And
yeah,
the whole point is to call attention to these neglected comic book stories from mostly the 40s and 50s, and then maybe steer the reader toward the originals, which are, of course, available, but certainly give them more than the trite and fatuous dialogue that distinguished the original printings.
Well, what interested me on it, I think one of the things that interests me about the books, and I've read several of them, I'm a fan of the series, and one of the things that really I have noticed that sometimes the changes or the amplifications, the emendations you make are very light. And at other times, I mean, sometimes if you're not looking for them, the only thing that you can recognize is that there's a little bit of change in the lettering style.
Right, the lettering style. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, on this new volume from the 1940s Ghost Gallery stories, the relettering is thorough.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I like to preserve original lettering when I can, and in fact, I will clone original lettering in order to write new phrases with
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Digital cloning is quite the thing, and of course, I've neglected the art of hand lettering for long enough to feel guilty about it, but I always reserve the right to go back and do some nice Ben Oda style hand lettering mm-hmm. when the opportunity strikes.
Well, sometimes that's the only way that you can tell that you're making changes, and some of them are really, really just tweaks, and then sometimes you just go full tilt.
And sometimes, yes, it all depends. As Robert Crumb says, it all depends on the mood I am. I'm in who I am today.
There you go.
But yeah, I've got some new hand lettering in a story that Dan Burr is just finishing up.
Oh, excellent! Excellent.
Oh yeah. And Dan is one of the great cats. He, you know, the kings in disguise that he did
right.
with our friend Jim Vance,
and On the Ropes as well. Yeah.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Dan and I'm working on a comics anthology called Deep in the Horrors of Texas.
Good.
And this is one that Dan and I have been talking about for quite some time. And
well, great.
Finally said, let's just do it.
Good. Yeah, that's kind of our MO these days, isn't it? Once we'd been doing this long enough, the statute limitations run out, and we knew they weren't going to catch us. It's very, very liberating.
Oh yeah, and to go back and look on the successes and failures all mixed yep. together sometimes, you think, gosh, didn't we have a lot of fun doing that? And some of it even holds up pretty well.
Right. Yeah, it's always nice to occasionally revisit what you've done. At the same time, keeping an eye on the future, of course, which is what you and I have always done throughout what I laughingly refer to as my career anyway. It's always kind of been, we've been very blessed in a lot of ways to be able to do this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and to be able to do what we're doing now, which I guess is a good lead in as any to get into the topic for tonight, the topic du jour, which is a film that you picked out. And it was a fascinating picture to me.
Fascinating picture, yeah. A psychological horror picture.
Called Guilty Hands.
Yes.
Right? And
that's the one.
And it's 1931, MGM. And essentially, it's about a man, Lionel Barrymore, who actually a lawyer, if I'm not, or a judge or a lawyer, I cannot remember now.
A very effective lawyer.
That's right.
Who has worked both sides of the fence.
That's right. Who kind of becomes obsessed with the whole notion of the perfect murder.
Right, and perfect crime yarns, I'm a sucker for those.
Yes, yes. And this, and I'm a sucker for, and we won't give away the ending, but I'm certainly a sucker for those kinds of weird endings, such as Guilty Hands has. And, you know, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about Lionel Barrymore as a kind of, this is almost, you could almost see this as part of a three-picture sort of touchstone of MGM horror pictures for Barrymore. And I never had thought of him before I saw this as a kind of almost a horror star, because he's in Mark of the Vampire for MGM, 35, and he's in Devil Doll, 36, both Todd Browning pictures.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely, and then Rasputin.
And Rasputin. So that's right, Rasputin around 32 or something for his Rasputin
right
picture?
Around the... He and Boris Karloff were trying to out spook each other with at MGM with Rasputin for Barrymore and for Karloff with the Mask of Fu Manchu. The Mask of Fu Manchu.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, he actually in this picture, I guess Woody Van Dyke was the A picture or the major studio equivalent of William Bodine, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had a reputation for doing things in one take. And some of the research I did on this picture indicates that Lionel Barrymore may have done a little bit of directing too. Did you find that in your research?
Oh, yeah. Barrymore often ghost-directed.
Just his scenes, or what would he do?
He established the tone. He was of the brothers, and of course their sister Ethel, all
right.
Prominent members of a stage family.
Mm-hmm.
Lionel was the most versatile and stable.
You mean in terms of personal behavior?
Personal behavior,
right.
and dependability. As well a scenarist and composer.
Mm-hmm.
He did it all, and a very accomplished etcher.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Had a fascinating career, and, you know, kind of a role model for the likes of us.
Right.
He did what felt like he wanted to do at the time and got away with it.
Now, do you know what birth order that they were? Is Lionel the oldest?
Lionel being the oldest.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yes, and the he was a great favorite at MGM. In fact,
mm-hmm.
His flirtations with typecasting, even though he never really got typecast, except maybe as Dr. Gillespie in the later years.
Right.
He would. In fact, he went to Guilty Hands directly from another portrayal of a foredoomed lawyer in A Free Soul.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that picture. Yeah. Well, you talk about typecasting. the woman, the other woman, I suppose, in it, because this is a pre-code film, and so they're very specific, or at least they can hint at a lot more than they could post 1934 about the relationships, sexual and otherwise, between the characters. Mm-hmm. And of course, Kay Francis is kind of in a relationship with the. Well, you wouldn't call him protagonist, would you? But the person that Lionel Barrymore's daughter wants to marry, Lionel Barrymore's character,
oh, yes,
doctor,
exactly.
wants to marry. And Kay Francis, I think people forget what a huge star she was, but she was typecast very early in her career because she went from being that sort of femme fatale into the Warner Brothers things where she was the kind of the queen of the woman's picture.
Right.
And, you know, toward the end of her career, actually at the end of her career, which to me would be interesting. Have you seen any of the films she made that she co-produced and starred in for Monogram there toward the end of her, at the end of her career?
Not in great volume, but the more you see of her, the more you need to see of her. She was very much a take charge type of artist.
Mm-hmm.
Not unlike Ida Lupino.
Right, right.
Who became Ida Lupino told me once that she felt secure in the early stages of her career because the industry considered her a bargain basement Betty Davis.
Yes.
But she became a very fine director specializing, as Kay Francis would in later years, in the film noir.
Mm-hmm. Well, these films noir that she did for, or at least they have, I guess, elements of film noir in them that she made for Monogram, she's, of course, the name above the title in all of them, but they have to do with, there's one called Wife Wanted, has to do with dating agencies, and
sure.
She plays a fading movie star in that, and that's in the 40s, 1946, when she was at least in her 40s, which in those days, you know, you're pretty well done, and
yep.
maybe even older than that, depending on what biography you read of when she was born. But then she was into that. She made a film called Allotment Wives, which was about the women who were marrying GIs that were overseas, and then take in order to get their government money if they were killed.
Right.
She made three of those pictures, another one called Divorce. All of them were sort of salacious, or at least had the exploitable elements that Monogram liked. And she produced these, or co-produced them. I guess Trim Carr was even involved, the head of Monogram, as a producer.
Yeah.
And here she was, and she had been the queen, really, of the Warner Brothers lot. You talked about Betty Davis. Betty Davis is the one that superseded her at Warner Brothers, right?
Uh-huh, that's right.
People don't really realize how big of a star Kay Francis was. Here she's a pretty, well, I don't know if evil is the right word, but she's kind of amoral in it.
She's very much so, and involved in an affair with the character played by Alan Mowbray, who wants to marry Barrymore's innocent daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And that wonderful speech where Barrymore is trying to warn his daughter, played by Madge Evans,
is descriptive.
Why this fellow is a beast about women. He's mm-hmm. just like an animal. Your wedding night, instead of being a thing of beauty, will be a horror and a shame. And it's like, boy, I mean, this guy means business.
He's
not just intending to warn her. He's intending to step in and do something about it.
That's right. And you just never know, because the acting choices in the picture are very interesting. They're not just stage bound, although I think that's part of it. There's a lot of there's some stage influence in it. But there's just some very curious choices, and the relationship between the Madge Evans character and Lionel Barrymore, her dad, is very creepy in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
It's an odd relationship. You know, he kids her about the wedding night, as you say, or didn't kid her, but he talks about the wedding night, and it's just a kind of a little bit of a creepy relationship that the two of them have.
When MGM got creepy, they got really creepy.
They got plenty creepy. They were like Paramount in that way, weren't they? Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, MGM was usually steered clear of the really scrofulous material, but boy, when they indulged, of course, the director Van Dyke had come to this picture, which was his first mystery.
Yes.
From more of an actionful, two-fisted, very virile slate of films,
mm-hmm.
and of course he liked it so well that he ended up directing The Thin Man.
Right, right.
Just 3 years later.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't long at all. Yeah, and you know, I found out this is just apropos of nothing, but also these two, Madge Evans and Lionel Barrymore, played father and daughter again in a huge picture in 1933, Dinner at Eight.
Oh yeah,
they were father and daughter then.
One of the great Grand Hotel type pictures.
Exactly, with the huge cast and all that sort of thing. But I think, you know, one of the things I really like about this picture, and we don't want to destroy it for anybody who hasn't seen it, but the very early part of it, when it's all dark and they come out into the light, and there's Lionel Barrymore sitting on the train and talking to some fellow passengers, and one of the things that he says at the very beginning, which I think foreshadows kind of the really unusual ethical makeup of the picture, is he says at that point, he says, "We don't have morals anymore, just laws."
Oh,
and this is 1931, right? And
that's,
you
right.
know, great foreshadowing line that he says
and,
there,
and a line that might be more relevant today than ever before.
Yeah, it kind of makes you know, you start thinking about, that's 1931. That's the year that Dracula came out, and here we are still dealing with the same sort of, still wrestling, I guess, with the same sort of truths.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, the more you think about the picture, even though it does play out a little bit like an O. Henry thing, if you really, O. Henry story, like if you really get down to it.
A twist ending.
Yeah, with a twist ending, or EC, if you'd prefer.
Mm-hmm.
There's still some moral ground that they deal with there, that I think is really adds an underpinning to the picture that makes it more interesting.
Definitely, the viewer and the film is easily found. It plays fairly regularly on the Turner Classic Movies Network.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, good.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But is readily found, and all the better for that. But the viewer might be advised to take a really close look at the scene where the silhouette is pacing.
Yes, yes.
The figure is pacing in the scene through a window. And
when we
like
have the two African-American characters in there who are watching watching that scene.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And you get not only a hint of the finale or the denouement, but you mm-hmm. also get a hint of the obsessiveness of Barrymore's character. And then, of course, he does deal with his the figure of whom to whom he objects, the prospective bridegroom,
mm-hmm.
And then confronts Kay Francis, threatening to frame her for murder.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my goodness. It's like, and this wonderful, wonderful confrontation. You look at her, the woman who was fired with jealousy, killed her lover to regain the millions he'd left her in a will he didn't live long enough to destroy. And then he pauses and says, I swear I'll put you in the electric chair.
That's
like,
right.
Whoa, whoa. And she takes it pretty stoically, but you can tell that she's kind of unnerved on top of that.
You certainly can. And you can also tell that here's a character who's trying to cover up a really dark nature with some outwardly sort of gestures, mannerisms, mm-hmm. You know, tones of speech. Trying to maybe let people think he's something other than he really is down deep.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he really does believe that when he says we don't have morals, we just have laws, he's a lawyer. And maybe law takes the place of morals for him. I mean, I don't know. It leads to all kinds of interesting thoughts if you really take a look at the underpinning of the picture and the themes of the picture.
Yeah, very, very much like the what would become the image of the Hollywood mad doctor.
Yes, that's right.
The belief that one's great quest is above the law.
Right, meddling in God's domain, things that
tampering,
man would not.
Yeah, tampering with things man was meant to leave the hell alone.
That's exactly right, and that's kind of what he did. I mean, he does take the law into his own hands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because at one point you remember during the murder scene, he tells his victim, "Meet you in hell,"
mm-hmm.
and there you have it. You know,
yes, a word they could not have gotten away with just a few years later.
You know,
after
I guess that's true.
He took over.
Yeah, after the boys, as someone said, I've been reading a lot about that lately, and I never realized just how much the Catholic Legion of Decency had to do with the production code. And when the Breen office came in, when Joseph Breen came along,
yeah.
And they were calling the shots.
Well, Joe Breen was a plant.
Yes, exactly.
He was installed in the Motion Picture Association.
By the Legion of Decency, essentially.
Yes, by
right?
the Legion yeah. of Decency. And it's like, could you be more... possibly be more overt with greater impunity? Well, you know, in a lot of the modern day political scene nowadays, we are seeing a lot of that happen again.
Well, we are.
Yeah.
That's absolutely,
you know, censorship right. will. You can't just knock down an oppressive code of censorship and wipe your hands of it and say, well, we fixed that all right, and then
right.
walk away from it. You got to be diligent and vigilant.
That's right. That's exactly right. And you're right. It's just like this whole deal about we don't have morals anymore, just laws. I mean, it really seems to be relevant to today. A lot of this picture, we don't want to make more of it than it is. Was this a programmer? Was this for MGM? Was this a programmer? Was it an A picture? What was it, Michael?
This was a top-of-the-line picture.
It was.
This was a tremendously prestigious picture. Hans Stromberg was one of the most powerful producers, not only at MGM, but in the film industry at large.
Right.
And you know, I mean, he made Oscar bait. Barrymore landed an Academy Award for A Free Soul, the preceding picture. The other doomed lawyer I mentioned.
Okay, A Free Soul was the name of that picture?
A Free Soul.
A Free Soul.
And it's a powerhouse, too.
Okay, good. And so this was not, I mean, Barrymore was a box office draw?
No, Barrymore was top of the line. He was probably the most not only the most appealing, not in the matinee idol sense, but the most reliable, bankable star MGM had. partly because he worked both sides, mm-hmm. behind the cameras and in front of the cameras.
I see.
He also was, you know, a director, dramatic coach, casting advisor,
uh-huh.
and the Guilty Hands was written for his personality, for Lionel Barrymore's personality, by a famous playwright named Bayard Veyer.
Right, and he was a Barrymore, of course, on top of everything else.
And being
America
a
was, yeah. Was, you know, I read recently again, Goodnight, Sweet Prince, and, you know, a terrific biography of Barrymore by Gene Fowler, of John Barrymore, who was not very stable, and apparently, you know, apparently Lionel was the stable one of the bunch, I suppose.
Right.
So the other person I want to bring up, because there may be some folks out there that are big silent movie fans, is Polly Moran.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
As Aunt Maggie, and Polly Moran, I guess, had been one of the biggest of the Mack Sennett comedians, right?
Right, right.
And
found a niche, unlike so many of the silent stars, found a workable niche in the talking pictures.
And playing characters, essentially.
Right.
Character parts. And so if she looks familiar, if you're a Mack Sennett fan, that's where you've seen her. I guess I haven't seen a lot of her silence. Have you seen a lot of her silence?
Not that many, but those I've seen, yeah. Uh-huh.
And right. She was pretty funny, huh?
She was funny, rowdy, uh-huh. boisterous.
Right.
I would, from what little I've seen of her greater body of silent work, I'd put her up there with Louise Fazenda.
Really? Wow.
As a laugh getter.
Well, that's high praise. And so this film is not hard to see. You know, I'm a Luddite, and I don't have cable or anything else, so it's not hard to find this picture.
No. Okay. No. I've watched it several times on the Turner Classic Network.
Well, what I do with Joey, our producers, I just say, Joey, this is the film we'd like to see, and then I come in here and we watch it. It's pretty much it. It's like magic to me. You know,
if you can get away with it.
It is indeed. So we'll be doing a couple of films next. We're going to mix it up a little bit and do short. I guess, I don't know what you call this, reviews, discussions, whatever, on a couple of pictures in conjunction with a new Frederick Brown double volume anthology that's going to be coming out in the spring from Hafner Press. I'm looking forward to seeing the Anita Ekberg film again, Screaming Mimi.
Screaming Mimi, yes.
Which is a wonderful book. Frederick Brown was when he was out there, he was way out there. And,
he was like a pulpier Cornell Woolrich.
He was. That's exactly right. He could load the trucks with the best of them, but sometimes he just took a hard left turn. So mm-hmm. we're going to be talking about him a little bit next week. But right now, I'd like to wrap up, Michael, by talking about, I've been noticing, and we want to thank the people who have been dipping into the Forgotten Horrors book, some of which I helped on with you.
Yeah.
And they seem to be doing very well, very consistent sales online, and we just want to say thanks. I mean, it's a nice thing for people to be going out and buying those.
The objective is to not only get the books out where people are reading them, but to make them as interactive as possible.
Yes.
In the sense of keeping, and that's why we, of course, do this podcast, to keep the lines open for people to communicate with us. And,
right.
We have encouraged that ever since the first volume of Forgotten Horrors came out in 1979.
With you and George Turner.
George Turner, yes, mm-hmm. exactly. And that it's easier to do so now because of the social media scene.
Right, right. And we want to encourage anyone who would like to suggest a film, which we've had happen quite a little bit here this past year, to suggest a film that they'd like to hear us talk about. We'd like to watch it and talk about it ourselves.
Yep, yep.
And I will let you know one more thing before you. This is a little bit outside our purview, but I just learned today that my book with the old New York Yankee pitcher Ralph Terry, called Right Down the Middle, which is available now on Amazon and other sites, is a finalist for the Oklahoma Book Award. So I'm very excited about that. And
that's great.
If we have some crossover fans, I mean, it's almost baseball season. Well, it is baseball season by the time this comes out, or pretty close anyway. The spring is here, baseball season again. To check out Right Down the Middle, I'm very proud of the book, and I'm proud I was able to tell Ralph Terry's story, the only man in Major League Baseball history to have pitched the last pitch in two World Series Game 7s.
Yep.
So there you have it.
Sweet. Well, we probably also ought to mention, in case anybody is in the mood to do some voting for the for their favorite.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That,
yeah.
That the eighth volume, I'm saying, yes, the new, one of the newer volumes of Forgotten Horrors, subtitled The Resurrection of Edgar Allan Poe, is among the nominees for Book of the Year in the Rondo Awards,
nice.
Rondo Hatton Classic Horror Awards.
And what do you just go on there? Anybody can vote, I think, if you go online.
Anybody
right?
can vote, and of course, you know, I mean, it's a great lineup of nominees. I'm very, very honored to be amongst such good company. Anybody can vote, and the way to do it, to find the ballot, is to get online at rondoaward.com.
Rondoaward.com. All right. Very good.
The deadline for voting is April the 19th.
And if there is a section on a podcast, we'd appreciate your consideration.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, write-ins are always welcome.
That's right, especially if you're writing our names, doubly welcome in these quarters. Well, Michael, thank you. I enjoyed it as always. We'll be back before you know it, with a double header, a twofer.
Here on Forgotten Frederick Brown podcast. Lives, yes.
Frederick Brown indeed lives. Thank you. Be talking to you soon.
Back with you.
Bye.